Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'd just like to say before I begin my talk that I found this to be an absolutely fabulous conference. The talks have been uniformly interesting, and I've managed to get a lot of material to draw from. I've been able to draw from quite a bit of that material even for this presentation today. So I think all credit to David and the rest of the organizing committee for putting on just a wonderful conference. I've really enjoyed it. I'm going to talk in broad strokes today. I'm going to make some sweeping generalizations, which I'm sure David would say is nothing unusual for me. I'm going to draw some issues in black and white, and of course the issues aren't in black and white, there are much more nuances. I'm going to give you, if you will, an overview, and for those of you who read my newsletter or look at my website, you might think of this as a field guide to my newsletter, a field guide to my website. I was forced to provide an abstract for my talk some time ago, and so that's the talk that I'm stuck with now. But the topic is reusable media, social software, and openness in education. And the way I introduced this in my abstract was by talking about a dichotomy between the consumers and the producers of information or content. And I'm going to draw from that a bit, because of course that's one of these, you know, black, white, yin, yang things that aren't absolutes, because of course, you know, we aren't consumers, we aren't producers, we're a little bit of both. So when I draw lines like that, I don't mean it just that way. I don't mean to divide the world into producers and consumers. I'm not saying that's the way the world is divided. But I'm going to pull a bunch of these things out. I style myself, the career that I've chosen for myself, if you will, is that of what William Gibson calls Idoru. And in the book of the same name, Idoru is defined as intuitive perceiver of patterns of information. And that's what this talk is about. This talk is about patterns. And broad strokes, patterns in events, patterns in technology and software, patterns in cognition and the way we think and the way we create knowledge and the way we transfer knowledge. May of 1995, and I still remember it well, which in a way is kind of sad because it dates me, but in a way is kind of nice because it gives me a context. The most amazing thing happened on the internet, and the amazing thing was that people who used to use information services like CompuServe and Prodigy, and especially America Online, joined the internet. And from the point of view of those of us who were already on the internet, it was like this flood of AOL newbies, It was like you take this room and imagine the same number of people, only children, all came flooding into the room, all sat at the front and started asking questions. It felt like that. It was the most wonderful thing. Now the question is, what prompted that? Why did AOL decide in 95 to join the internet? And Tim O'Reilly, who was with a company called Global Network Navigator that sold to AOL at the time, says, gradually people are beginning to realize that free means access, not price. AOL could not provide access. It was a closed proprietary system, and for AOL and the others to survive, they had to become open. But the story doesn't end there. I'm just as an aside, I'm experimenting with timing on my slides. This is the first time I've ever done this. The slides will keep going relentlessly no matter what I say. The story didn't end there because, of course, AOL went into this sort of only half-heartedly, sort of as O'Reilly said, wishing the internet would go away and allow it to get back to its traditional business of providing a closed space, vertical media market, proprietary technology, control over the message. Everybody goes to AOL. AOL is where the community is. AOL is where the content is. Now, sometimes the slides are going to go too slowly. This difference between AOL and the internet can be characterized along a number of dimensions, and it's these dimensions that I want to use to highlight the distinction between what I believe is the coming picture of learning and the going away picture of learning. The coming picture of learning, the one that we want to work toward, is open, where there is access for everybody, open in the sense of the internet, open in the sense that if you can type in a URL, you can go to a website, as compared to the closed spaces, such as AOL or Prodigy, where you have to go use their service, use their conditions and terms of service. There's not just open and closed. Another dimension is the distinction between broadcast and conversation. In traditional media, what we see is broadcast. They speak, you listen. You go to your home, your hotel room today, you turn on the television, in all probability, you will not be talking back to your television. Or even if you are, because I do frequently, it turns out they do not listen. As contrasted with the model of communication on the internet, where communication is two-way. As anyone who's published a blog understands, as soon as you put something out on the internet, people start sending you stuff back. This is great. This is awful. You should move to wherever, so on and so forth. A third dimension of this dichotomy is the distinction between institution and individual. And this is where a lot of my clashes with David lie. My perception, and I might be wrong, but you know, the way I've sort of caricatured him in my mind, which is what I do, I caricature little pictures, big noses. The old way is centered around the institution, government, corporation, Microsoft, broadcasting agency, AOL Time Network. The new way of the internet is centered around the individual, the personal website, the blog, the email address. The fourth dimension is the organization of this system, the organization not only of communication, but the organization of business, the organization of learning. And we contrast here between the hierarchy, where there's a director, a president, or a CEO at the top, and instructions and information diffuse from the top and are sent to the peons, as compared to a network where there is no one person in control. A further dimension is between the concept of centralized and decentralized. And then we can go back to AOL and the internet. AOL was centralized. Everybody went to AOL. The internet is decentralized. You may go to a website here, you may go to a website from my home in Moncton, you may go to a website from Africa or Iran or wherever. The organization and the location of the material and where the decisions are made occurs in many places rather than in a central place. What Lawrence Lessig talked about in the opening keynote to this conference, he talked a lot about Remix. He didn't draw out the way I would have liked the contrast between Remix, but the contrast with Remix is what I might call product. Remix is when you mess around with song files for yourself and create something. Product is when you go to HMV or something like that and buy a shrink-wrapped jewel case with a prepackaged CD-ROM with all the music already laid out in order for you, and you do not change that. Remix is when you put your own photos and videos on the net. Product is when you watch television and they plan the shows and you watch the shows as they were planned and delivered. Which leads us to our next dimension, planned versus chaotic. And I'll come back to chaotic quite a bit during the course of this talk. Some people may say the talk itself is an instance of chaotic. But it's the idea that you can plan and organize everything up front versus the idea that things develop on their own in a natural way. The idea of putting things into a precise sequence versus the idea of each step being self-determining. Each step following from the last, but not necessarily depending on the last. Static versus dynamic. Television shows are static. Once an episode of Cheers is made, it's made. It never changes. The web is dynamic. Once somebody creates a wiki page, who knows what it'll be tomorrow? In the field of learning, we have trouble with this because we have this vocabulary of learning objects, and learning objects gives us a picture of something that is static. And we want to talk about it according to its properties. But learning objects are something that should be thought of as something dynamic. People ask me for the analogy that I like to use for learning and what e-learning is. And I say e-learning is like electricity, not like Legos. It's something that flows. It's like the water system. It's something that should be available in the wall, where it comes out, it changes. It's not concrete. It's not the same thing you got yesterday, which we're really happy about with water, because we wouldn't want yesterday's water. It's the distinction between push and pull. Broadcast media pushes. It tells you what you're going to see. As opposed to pull, which is the model of RSS, which I'll talk a little bit about, where you, the consumer, go out and get what you want. You pick what web page you're going to see. You pick what blog you're going to read. Now we have this set of dichotomies. And what made this happen, because we didn't have this set of dichotomies when I was growing up, at least not really. But what happened, and Leslie talked about this, and many other people have talked about this, is that when the internet arrived on the desktop, it gave people a whole new set of capacities. And a lot of people have talked about the same sort of thing that happened when the printing press came out. I like to think about what happened when writing came out, because when writing came out, people had this capacity to express information in a way that they never did before. And imagine when writing was invented, the possibility that writing would be everywhere. On this desk, evacuation procedure statement. On the walls, when you need it. People can create writing all by themselves. This is a fantastic development. And the same thing has happened with the internet. We can create a new kind of content for ourselves. We have wonderful tools. We have simple text editors. I use one called NoteTab. Love it. Email clients, so we can send for ourselves a message around the world. HTML to design things. Also, the technology. This is the slides pacing me. You know that. Otherwise, this would be a four-hour talk. The technology also gives us access to new markets. Before the internet, and I remember these days, my power of communication extended to the room that I was in, maybe a bit further if I shouted, and I did shout from time to time because I wanted to be heard. And that's it. But today, with the various technologies, I have a global reach. I have a global reach not just in terms of distance, I have a global reach in terms of audience. I can reach out beyond my own community, my own group. There's a capacity I never had. Now the point I made in my abstract, and it's in this slide here because it's in my abstract, I'm stuck with it, because it's a bit of an overgeneralization, is that traditional media and traditional services view this new development quite rightly as a threat. Think about the fax machine. Some of you may recall the introduction of the fax machine. I'm still wrapping my mind around the idea that there are people possibly in this room who have grown up and there's always been a fax machine. But before the fax machine, what people did is they would actually send physical messages from one place to another. And it sounds like an odd idea, but that's what we had at the time. When the fax machine was introduced, the courier companies said, this is great. We will offer an electronic messaging transfer service. You come to us, you give us this message, we'll make a digital copy of this message and send it over the wires. Instead, the business was basically destroyed. Look at television. Now, everybody still has a television. It's one of these things that's sort of just beginning to pass its peak. What we're seeing in news articles and items these days, the internet has surpassed the television. And more importantly, the role of the television in our lives is changing. It is moving from becoming an upfront medium to a background medium. The radio is now. There's a major change in the status of television. Some of you will have heard of something called Skype. Skype, or something like that, will basically destroy long-distance telephone service. Because Skype, basically, is internet long-distance telephone. It's free. You know, you need your internet connection. You load your program on. You call up your friend. If your friend has Skype, you have a free, high-quality voice connection with them. So the call that used to call you, I don't know, $90 or whatever, if you want to talk to Australia for an hour or so, now costs you nothing. Now, of course, you know, we're still in the early stages, so there are cases where we have to interface between Skype and the traditional telephone system, and that costs money. And of course, there's talk about regulating it, and that costs money. But Skype replaces long-distance telephony. Blogging. I participate in online news mailing lists. And the online journalists are, in the one sense, fascinated, and in the other sense, scared to death of blogging. Newspaper circulations have begun to drop, and they've begun to drop most dramatically in the youngest demographic. As many people now get their news off the internet as they do reading the newspaper. Circulations are dropping. And what's happening, it's not simply that people are using a new medium, but people are getting their news from new sources. You find out about events in Russia or Georgia, not from the New York Times, but from Yusuf, who lives down the block from where it happened. Now, in general, these new technologies evolve in two stages. The first stage, and this is pretty much where we're at in the world of digital media, it duplicates existing processes and services. Just like when we got the internal combustion engine, the first thing we got was the horseless carriage. Just like when we got refrigeration, we got ice boxes. And the second step, it obliterates them. But, and part of the point of this talk is, this is not a Hegelian sort of historical determinism here. This is a set of choices that we make, and this talk is about the choices that we make. Traditional media understands this, and they know that if they put in the right kind of systems and structures, they can resist this change. And they look at the new technology and the new affordances. I was looking for a place to use affordances. A new affordances that it offers, and it sees itself being threatened in three areas. One area is in the area of production. And this is a business model change. It's not so much a technological change, although it's an effect of technology. In the old model, production was enabled by demand. Work for us, produce what we want you to produce, or through the mechanisms of finances and governmental structure, we will cause you to starve. That was the mechanism. The new mechanism is volunteer. You choose what you will contribute into society. The contrast is between encyclopedia, where they hired a bunch of people to produce this massive 24-volume set that sells for $2,000, $3,000, and Wikipedia, which was produced with a labor cost of, well, I guess nothing. Another tension is in business models. And you've read and heard about this a great deal. The distinction between proprietary and commercial software or products, because it's not just software, and free and open source. And the old way is the proprietary and the commercial software. And this is the model, this is the commercial business model that is under siege because of the new technology. The new technology allows not just for the distribution of open softwares, as some of the people in this conference have talked about so far, it also allows for the creation of it in the first place, because we can organize ourselves into a programming entity that has as much capacity as a centralized system such as Microsoft. And then finally, business models in traditional media are threatened in terms of distribution models. The music industry, which I'm sure you're all familiar with the debate surrounding the music industry, is on the verge of being destroyed by peer-to-peer content. Now, I know they're fighting back, and this fight will continue, I'm sure, until I retire. But if you look at sales and profits, they've peaked, they're declining. But again, and I want to emphasize, this is not historical determinism. Rory McGreal likes to talk about, in the context of standards, how the Romans decided that roads would be one chariot width wide, and this width has carried down over the years to determine the size of our rail tracks, and therefore the size of the boosters on the shuttlecraft. And so the size of the boosters on the shuttlecraft is determined by a decision made more than 2,000 years ago. So this is not inevitable. So even as we are bringing our local forms of communication, conversation, sharing, community, the global forms, the broadcast, the centralized, the proprietary, the commercial, are bringing themselves into our home, into our lives. Things like copyright, things like air miles and purchase points. When somebody complains to you, and this has happened to me, I use the word Coke or Xerox or something like that in a message, and somebody always writes, "Well, you can't write that word without using a little C after it, or you shouldn't use that word to refer to a generic process." This is the centralized model intruding itself right into my speech. Lessig drew this out beautifully. If technology means everything is a copy, and if copyright law covers copying, and then copyright law covers everything. This is a major intrusion and a major change. As I said, it's infiltrating not just our homes. People are putting controls, they want to put controls into our computers under the rubric of trusted computing, whereby, and this was actually raised in a case in, I believe it was Finland, where they said the person had trespassed. Where had the person trespassed? Because he cracked a CSS DVD descrambling system. He had trespassed on his own computer, because he had broken into a piece of software on his own computer. So it's coming right into our homes and right into our language, as I mentioned before. So the message here is, the internet does make us more free. It gives us more capacity. But even as we are becoming more free, the calls, and by calls I mean not just oration and agitation, I mean a wide variety of tactics and strategies that I'll talk about a wee bit, for a closed network are becoming more insistent and more pervasive. And for those of you who read my newsletter, this is why I get so strident. Because they are persistent and they are pervasive. And in many cases, they're winning. But what sort of things do I mean? Well, look at bundles. Bundling. You read people like Shapiro and Varian, their book Information Rules, they talk about bundles and all of that. And bundles is the new marketing strategy. Bundles have been with us for a long time, but we're seeing this more and more and more. Music albums, that's a bundle. All you wanted was one song, but you bought 14. Pre-formatted radio is a bundle. right? You listen to that rap song because that other song that you want after it is the one you like. So on and so forth. Journal bundles, things like that. You probably saw it on the slide. I kind of missed it. Closed spaces and markets. One of the big things to sweep the internet over the last year has been these social networks. But if you go to these social networks, you go to Friendster or Orkut, they're closed. I don't mean that they're closed in the sense that nobody can get in. Well, although Orkut is kind of that way. But they're closed in the sense of the community exists only in the context of Friendster or only in the context of Orkut. You can't communicate between Friendster or Orkut. You have these closed systems that you have to go into. Newspapers are becoming like that with newspaper registration. You have to register and go into this closed newspaper website from which there are no links out. Learning design. This is another place where I talk with David. The idea that learning is something that's prepackaged, structured, where you as the students are like an actor in a play, and the instructor or the designer will be like the director, and they will tell you how to play a role, what to say, what to do, versus the approach promoted by people like Seymour Papert, James Paul Gee, of learning structured or designed as a game, which is open-ended, where you decide for yourself what you were going to do. Media formats. You'd think learning design, media formats, completely different issues, but it's the same issue. PDF, which pervades our lives and tells us how we are going to read something, versus HTML, which is open and free form. Real media, or even worse, Windows Media Format, which sometimes doesn't even work on Windows, versus MP3, which is something that can be played by anyone, anywhere. Digital rights. I've been up to my ears in digital rights expression languages over the last couple of years because of my involvement with the EduSource project as the package manager for the DRM part of the project. And the presumption of digital rights expression going in is that anything that is not explicitly permitted is prohibited. Now imagine if you governed yourself in society that way. Unless there's a law that says you can walk on the sidewalk, you can't. There was a fascinating talk by Dan Rehak about Cordra, and he says behaviors, services, identification, authorization, authentication, digital rights, all these have to be built into the system ahead of time for it to work. Do they? Did we do digital rights before we came up with blogs? Did we do digital rights and authentication before we came up with the web and home pages? Was I not able to send an email before I could attach an XML description of it detailing exactly how the receiver could use it? Receiver of patterns of perception of information. When we know what we're looking for, we can see it everywhere. Now, sometimes that's called paranoia. But it's like mathematics. Once you understand, you can count things. You can count things all over the place. So, I'll draw that out a bit. And look at the types of barriers and impediments that characterize the centralized, proprietary, closed type of system that I've been talking about, as opposed to the open type of system that I argue that we want to move toward. One of these is obvious, and I'm sure every one of you is familiar with it. It's called lockout. It's like the lock on your front door, only it's digital. It's a subscription fee to access certain stories in the Chronicle of Higher Education. It's seems to me to be ironic in the highest degree. It's registration forms to view the news. Again, ironic. It's network authentication. Now, again, it's not all black and white. Sometimes we need this. I want a lockout system to govern the management of the ATM system. But when we are talking about systems of knowledge, news, learning, information, that kind of lockout is inappropriate. Even more subversive, even more insidious, is the idea of lock-in. And again, you read all this new economics stuff, you read a lot about lock-in. There's proprietary content, proprietary software. Everyone has to use Word because Word is the only software that understands a Word file. It's closed markets. Go to a grocery store and notice a trend that more and more the products on the shelves of the grocery store are being replaced with generic store brands, because they know when you go to a grocery store, they can determine the set of options available to you. And the more they can narrow that, the more they can determine what your purchasing patterns will be. High bar. This is talked a lot about by people who have to deal with things like educational technology standards. I remember when IMS first landed on my desk, and IMS landed on my desk as about a 2-inch stack of paper, and it actually made a thud when it hit. And I said, this is great, this is exactly what we want, we need to implement this, because I was young and naive. And when I started showing it to the instructors, they actually turned pale. Flooding, that's something I talked with David a little bit about, because we have this idea, and Lawrence Lessig talks about this idea, that, you know, if we just make Creative Commons and free and open content one of the options, then people will be able to naturally go toward it. But that's not how it works in the marketplace. And if you look at the marketing strategies of companies like Starbucks, even if people offered free coffee on the corner, people would still go to Starbucks, because everywhere you turn, there's a Starbucks. On the internet, that tactic is known as spam. And then finally, the legal barriers that are thrown up against openness and sharing. It's fascinating that we live in a society where openness and sharing can actually be considered crimes. We have the attack on fair use. Again, Lessig mentioned, publishers don't even bother with fair use anymore. It's like that right no longer exists, because the threat of being sued outweighs any benefit they could gain from exercising their right. Now, the reason why I get strident, the reason why I come and do broad strokes, generalization talks like this, is because as a community, in my perception, we are complying